Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy. My call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob KD2NVB will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's Technet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website. It's colored in orange color type, but if you would like a simple URL for your browser to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. We also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to kc2rc-r. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD, KD2NVB will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with a word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or you can email us. Our email address is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. Look forward to a nice net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. Likewise, Bob. I hope we have some participants tonight and some interesting discussions. So this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're open for business. If you anyone out there with any questions or topics for discussion, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. Well, what do you know? We're having another kind of slow beginning for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So this is not the first time this has happened, and probably this will not be the last time this has happened. So we'll try to raise the troops a little bit more. I'll tell you my hard luck story from last Sunday. I was finishing up the 10-meter net, which was very, very local. DX stations were coming out of Queens, New York. That's how bad propagation conditions were. And after it was over and done, I noticed some strangeness going on in my network. Every time I rebooted a device, it no longer was able to establish a connection with the worldwide internet. The local network in my house worked, but the internet didn't for that device. So I decided I was going to be clever and then reboot my router, which is usually the reason why something like that happens. Unfortunately, when I rebooted my router, I found that my router no longer was recognized by the internet and couldn't establish a connection. So my whole house was disconnected from the internet. And I do a lot of things through the internet, so that was a little annoying. It was about 1:30 or so. Anyway, called up Verizon, because usually they just kind of reset something at the central office, and I'm back online. Unfortunately, I couldn't get away from that stupid robot, so the synthetic voice would tell me that there were local outages in my area, but not to worry. They will be resolved within 24 hours. So, golly gee. And was there anything further they could do for me? Like not having internet for 24 hours was enough. I tried to get a human being. Really seemed to have problems. So hung up. Called back an hour later, called back an hour later, called back an hour later, called back an hour later. Finally, able to get a human being. A human being didn't know what I was talking about, local outages. She kind of told me what they usually tell me, which is the router, which I had already done. And she said, okay, if you already did that, then disconnect the cable connection to the router. I did that. Now reboot the router. I did that. And she looked at readings on her side, and she said, you know, I have Fios, Verizon Fios, one of the earlier versions of the fiber optics. So there is a fiber optic converter with a battery connection so that I don't lose telephone connectivity. And she said, you have a small box someplace in your residence that has a battery next to it. I need you to disconnect the battery and disconnect the outlet connecting it and go back to the router and disconnect the coax cable and turn off the router and let it sit there for about 10, 20 minutes and then slowly reboot the ONT and connect the router and plug it in. And by about 9:30 in the afternoon, in the evening, I finally reestablished my internet connection and was kind of exhausted. So I called it a night. Unfortunately, I had to cancel the Limark technical net because it goes on at 8 o'clock. And again, I actually go in through AllStar, which requires a internet link. So that was a big pain in the backside. So that was how I spent my Sunday night. Hopefully that little storytelling gave everyone an opportunity to remember it's Wednesday, time for the technical net. So once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the net control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club technical net. So once again, if anyone out there has any questions or topics for discussion tonight, please hit that push to talk and give me your name and your call sign. Well, it looks like this is going to be very reminiscent of our last Kings County Radio Club technical net, where except for kind of William kind of coming by and leaving, it was just you and me, Bob. So I told my little story. I'm kind of storied out at this point. We'll give it a little bit more time for someone to come up and knock on the door and ask a question, but we'll see. Maybe it's just not a good season for a technical net.
K2NBB here. Yeah, I'm here. I'm getting up very early tomorrow morning, but I'll hang in there, but maybe there won't be anything. William, anybody out there? Maybe Maxim? Anybody out there?
Well, it looks like it's just us. Let me see. What other short stories can I recite? I bought a new keyboard. I felt as though I've had this very interesting keyboard. It's a mechanical keyboard. I like mechanical keyboards. I really hate membrane keyboards. And this one is, I think it's an ASWD code key keyboard. Very nice. Black. Lights up with white LEDs, and it has shine-through keycaps. The problem sometimes with shine-through keycaps is that the what they mean by shine through is the light in the key switch can shine through and illuminate, you know, what letter or number that keycap is designated for. But as time goes on, your fingers rub up against it and you wear it out, and more becomes transparent. And instead of a nice sharp A, you kind of slowly lose the little triangle in the middle of the A, and it's all kind of a fuzzy white glow. So I figured I'd go for, and those keycaps are very expensive. About once a year, I buy a couple of replacement keycaps, and it could set me back $20 for just about three or four keycaps. Anyway, so I bought this new one. It's from a Chinese company called Newfie. And, you know, every year they try and do something new in the industry. So I got an RGB color keyboard that does a lot of color tricks and such. But there's something new. It's called VIA, V-I-A. It basically allows you to program the keyboard to do macros and to do multi-key levels. So you can have a modifier key, and it can change the key map or for unusual keys that sometimes you use, or macros that and letters and such. It's kind of a scripting language and a control language. The alternative key set can change the color displays, all kinds of fun stuff. So I'm having fun with my new keyboard, and QMX/VIA is the total designation for that type of technology now.
And VB here. You're probably hearing a lot of noise. My microphone's acting up. Anyway. Yeah, I messed with alternative keyboards. Oh, back in the 90s, I was starting to have some RSI issues when I was messing around with coding and stuff. And I tried alternatives to the QWERTY keyboard, and it just wasn't practical, I thought, because of, you know, different reasons, even though they were better. But then I found a keyboard that I wish they still made that was QWERTY, but they made the keys so it was a... The keys weren't all in a straight line. They were like a V. The left would slope towards the middle, and the right would slope towards the middle. And the wider out keys would be bigger and wider for the pinkies to have more room to where they hit the key. And it really was ergonomically better. But I wish they kept making that keyboard. When I got a Mac, it wouldn't work on a Mac. And it wouldn't work on the new kind of USB plugs. This is back in the day of PS2 plugs. Anyway, my little spiel about keyboards. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, AC2GS. Yeah, I vaguely remember those. They went out of style for a weird reason. Eventually, what all those guys started to do, they didn't do away with the V-shape. What they did was they kind of snapped the keyboard in half, and there's still a lot of them available. You might look into it, because I'm sure they're available for a Mac. Most of these mechanical higher-end keyboards have little switches between Windows and Mac. And they're just two components. So you have one for your right hand, one for your left hand, and they're usually angled the way that yours was, except that now they're kind of split in half.
Yeah, if they're split in half, that means you could angle it anyway. You have control how it angles, I guess. You got two exact separate pieces, right? You just kind of place them the way you want, the way you want to place them, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, yeah, but I think it's designed to be angled, because whenever I see, photographs where they're trying to advertise it, they're always in a kind of a V configuration, because it makes sense. If you're going to split it in half, it doesn't really make any sense to keep them straight.
I was thinking, like, you'd probably do a V, but someone might, like, a 50-degree angle, someone else might want a 47-degree angle. I'm talking about little fine points like that.
Yeah, you can certainly do that. I mean, it's supposed to be angled, but it's not, since it's floating and it's loose, you could make it any angle that you like. You know, so sort of depends on likes and dislikes and how big your hand is, all your hand is, and what have you. So, you know, you might want to look into that if you really liked it that much. I played with those. I didn't really get much out of them. I looked into Dvorak keyboard designations, but it's not like I'm a touch typist. I was a much better typist when I was a kid. We had a typewriter, and I taught myself how to use it. But I've, as the years have progressed, I've degenerated into almost a hunt and peck guy.
I kind of have too. I just recently Googled this. I could have done this years ago and figured, oh, it's so easy to disable the trackpad on your laptop, which always annoyed the hell out of me because the palms of my hands would hit it, and then the cursor would move. And it's so easy to just disable it and just use a Bluetooth trackpad on the side. It's so much easier to type now because my hands tend to rest on, you know, behind the keys.
I think they were working on things that were supposed to be intelligent enough to know the difference between your finger using the trackpad and your palm resting on it. I never got comfortable with trackpads because one of my earlier laptops was a ThinkPad. So I got very hooked on the TrackPoint. And to this day, my laptops are Lenovo's. So I still have the TrackPoint, and every so often an update of Windows will wake up the trackpad, and then I have to put it back to sleep because I have the same problem with that. But you know, at least my laptop has a TrackPoint, so I really don't need the trackpad.
I use the external Bluetooth trackpad also because my trackpad on my built-in laptop, it's a 2012, it's an old machine. It started to have physical dysfunction, and I was doing photo work in Lightroom, like cropping a photo where you drag the corner of a square to make it bigger and smaller, or a rectangle. And this thing wasn't working very well, so that was the other reason. I had to say it was so much easier now. Yeah, I like trackpads, but I just have a Bluetooth one to the right of the the laptop, and it's much better.
I've kind of gotten used to all kinds of strange things. I don't have a lot of surface area on my desk. So instead of using a mouse years ago, I switched to a trackball. And I find it very comfortable, very easy. I use the Logitech MX Ergo that allows you to have a little tilt up. And I find it very comfortable. I watched a YouTube recently where the guy complains that you shouldn't use your thumb for the trackball because that produces, you know, your index finger is much better suited for repetitive actions and you just asking for trouble with your thumb. I've never had any trouble with my thumb. I find it very comfortable, especially with the tilt-up on the trackball, to move the ball with my thumb and control the buttons with my side fingers there. I still remember some idiot from IT where I once worked came in and didn't know what to do with my poor trackball. He started to slide it against across the desk to get the cursor to move. Idiot that he was.
Yes, I like trackballs too. I used to be, before I had a Mac, I had a, you know, some kind of PC, forget what it was. But I had one of these, was it Logitech, or was this other trackball that had four different buttons? And I used the fingers for the trackball, but whatever, you know, and I'd often hit the buttons with the thumb or the other, depending which button. And there were four of them, so they had some interesting features. One of them, I think, was just the equivalent of a double click. You could program the buttons, the extra buttons, to do different things. But, yeah, the trackball is nice, and sometimes I just use, I had a 21-inch CRT monitor in those days, and I would sometimes just, like, you could just spin the ball to get from one edge to the other, or walk it with two fingers. And I like trackballs a lot, too. They're good.
Do you think it might have been a Kensington? Because I still have a Kensington someplace around here. It's not my favorite. My favorite these days is the Logitech. But Kensington has kind of always been a player with trackballs.
It was a Kensington. I think I've also used Logitech. Yeah, I like the Kensington. Yeah, that's the one where you just take the ball out of it and you can put it right back in. Yeah, it was a Kensington. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Yeah, I could still get with a trackball. But I never understood why anybody would want the traditional mouse where you have to push the mouse with your entire arm. You'd go off. I have a small table. I wouldn't even have room, and you'd have to start it again on the, because you didn't have enough room to get it across the cursor across the screen. And ergonomically, it was so much worse. I just don't understand why anybody would prefer that. That's my opinion on the traditional mouse.
AC2GS. Well, blame it on Xerox. Xerox built the first. I still remember that there's pictures on the internet of the first mouse that Xerox designed. You know, they had some ergonomic, get out of jail solutions for that problem. You could increase the speed of the cursor with a mouse move, and also then they discovered the concept of accelerating it. So, you know, if you get to a certain point, it'll go faster and cover less distance on your desk. So, you know, people kind of had the same complaints, and they considered software workarounds. Mice, I think, are still probably the number one, method of moving cursors around. I guess second best is trackpads, and poor track points are out there in the dust. You know, most people make fun of it, and even Lenovo sells some lines of laptops that don't even have a track point anymore. You have to actually get a ThinkPad from Lenovo to have them include a track point.
I never had virtually no experience with a track point. My guess is, I mean, right now I probably would prefer a trackpad or a trackball, but maybe this is largely just because I'm used to them. But, yeah, they all have those things where they, you know, the trackpad or the trackball, when they, you move it faster, it actually also puts it into a higher gear, kind of, and it shoots across the screen faster. In my case, I couldn't do a mouse because I got this really small computer table, and then part of what's left over, I got my head for my 7100 sitting on it. There's visually no room for a mouse either, but I never liked them in the first place. So, all right, yeah, that's my take on that.
Yeah, I put my trackball on the right-hand side. I have a desk with a blotter, and it's off the blotter. So there's about 8 by 8 inches of area that I could play around with. It would be rather stifling for a mouse. But like I said, it's perfect for my trackball. Anyway, it's 9:25. I'm curious if anyone is listening to us out there. This is supposed to be the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We do this twice a month. Maybe we should do it less. We do it on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. And we have a puzzle, but last time I think I tabled the puzzle because not really that, you know, I mean, I'd rather have an actual audience out there to do the puzzle. Anyway, this continues to be AC2GS. I'm curious, is there anyone out there? And if so, do they have any questions or comments for tonight?
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Delta Victor.
Hello there. How are you today?
Good evening, Roy. I'm doing well. Just had a question about lithium iron phosphate battery. So let me give you the pre-story. I have the Expert Power, which is a typical, same as by Eno, 12-volt, 12-amp power battery, which I purchased about 3 years ago. And I tested it a couple of times. It worked fine. But then I fully charged it and stored it for about 2.5 years. And a couple of days ago when I wanted to see what's going on with it, it's actually totally dead. It's showing about 1.3 volts. Tried to charge it. It wouldn't take the charge after like, I don't know, an hour and a half. And that's pretty much it. So I wanted to see if you have any ideas on it. Back to you, Roy. KD2MDB.
Okay, that's bad news. The only failures I've ever had with lithium iron phosphates is that they have a safety feature. If you try and draw too much current, all of a sudden there's an internal fuse that opens up, and the only way that you can reset it is to put it through a charge cycle, which sounds like what you did. Have you tried to you have a little bit of a voltage potential in this battery right now, right?
Yes, right now it's 1.3 volts, exactly 1.3.
Okay. I hope the protection circuits, because there's load balancing circuits on these things too. So, you know, it's possible that the load balancing circuit failed and you'd have to kind of disassemble the whole battery, and I don't know where you'd get the parts for it. I think the only thing you could really try is kind of a controlled bleed off of whatever voltage is there. So you get it down to the lowest voltage potential you can, and then try recharging it. My gut feeling is that there's something terribly, terribly wrong with the load balancing circuits. And I haven't seen anyone on the internet who, you know, other than guys who just like to take everything apart, you know, get anywhere with it. They tend to be designed for the specific cell configuration architecture for each battery. But that would be the only thing I could think of. Try a total discharge and then attempt to recharge again. And if it won't take the charge, other than disassembling it and playing around with the individual cells for your own edification, I don't think there's much of a solution. Have you tried Googling that? Did you get anything from Googling?
Yes, I did a little research, common solutions would be try to recharge it, you know, typical stuff. The only thing that I wanted to try, but there's very little information about this, it says you need to try to charge it with low voltage, but nobody says what is low voltage. Is it 3? Is it 5? Is it 7 volts? So I tried charging at 5 volts just from my link power supply that I'm using for the radio. And it wouldn't take 5 volts. It's just zero current. It's not drawing any current at all. I tried 7, 8 volts, you know, kind of play around, but zero. There's nothing going in. Tried it for about half hour. Took the measurement again, 1.3. It just doesn't change. It's like locked in at that voltage. It drops to about 1.29 if, you know, I test it again, but pretty much at 1.3. That low voltage charge, if I knew a little bit more about, but I could never get any more info as to exactly what voltage, for how long, and so on. but that's the only thing. But it's a good idea that you said that probably try to discharge it. I don't even, like, it just seems to be locked in. It wouldn't, maybe hooking up a, there's nothing I can hook up that's 12.8 volts because it's so low voltage. Maybe just the generic light bulb just to kind of kill it. Yeah, I don't know. That's the only thing I haven't tried with this. Go ahead, Ray.
I mean, any load that takes the watts that you think are still inside there should work fine. You just want something capable of handling the dissipation of what watts come out of it so that it doesn't overheat and burn. But I'll kind of flip it around the other end. How high a voltage potential have you been charging it with?
The Kings County Radio Club holds exam sessions every 2 months regularly. Please check KingsCountyRadioClub.com for more information.
Well, the charger that came with it, well, actually, I purchased it separately, but it's specifically designed for lithium iron phosphate batteries. I've never tested the voltage that it was charging it with, but it's designed to be charged with 14.4 volts. And a standby on this battery is 13.8. So now that I've had this problem, when I hook up the charger to it, it's like a two-stage or two-cycle charger, they call it. Because it's such a low voltage on the battery, it goes back and forth between 2.5 to 14.4, I can't recall. It was definitely over 14 volts. And it would stay 2.5 for about 3-4 seconds, switch to 14.2, 2.5, 14.2, and it would just keep going back and forth, and I think that's because the battery is so low in voltage, it's probably trying to, like, wake it up from deep sleep to actually give it a charge, but just like I said, that charge has been hooked up for over an hour, probably close to 2 hours, and it did not increase it by even a tenth of a volt, but yeah, typically, charging voltage would be around 14.2 volts.
Okay, so you have that covered, which is good and bad. Good that we can knock that off the list. Bad because that's not going to be the reason. Unfortunately, my gut feeling is that either the cells have failed, or more likely the load balancing circuitry for the cells are screwed up in some way. And you know, they're so kind of embedded in it. It's the lithium iron phosphate. Are individual cells with circuits protection, short circuiting, and load balancing circuits embedded in each of the cells, and all those are knitted together as part of the the positive and negative terminals of the battery. So it would be a pain in the backside to disassemble, and chances are you wouldn't be able to find replacement parts for any of it. So, you know, again, the only thing I could suggest is a complete discharge to dead. I wouldn't be terribly optimistic, but that's kind of the only thing I can think of anymore that you could do without having a lot more sophisticated equipment and spare parts for that. Which company was that sold you the lithium iron phosphate? You might contact them and ask them what they think could be done.
The company is Expert Power. They're sold on Amazon primarily. I think they have their own website, which according to reviews and you know, all the products, I've had actually some antennas and bases for antennas from Expert Power, and they're a pretty decent company. The only thing, this is kind of my fault. I shouldn't have neglected it for so long, because they say it loses about 2% of charge every month. So according to my calculations, I should have lost anywhere between 50 to 60% of the load on the battery. But the thing is, it was never used, really. I mean, I've tested it a couple of times. It was kept full. I don't understand why would it go bad by just sitting. I mean, okay, you could lose half of the charge, but all of a sudden, total death. I mean, this is really weird. I mean, this is literally brand new battery. Like, I probably used, 10% of the charge each time I was testing. Not even, I think it was like 5%. So it's just very weird that it would just give up from actually no use.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but you know, you kind of never know, depending upon whether the safety circuits have electrolytic capacitors in them. Sometimes it's always nice to run a little bit of current through your electrolytics. Otherwise, the dielectric will kind of decompose over time as well. That's why a lot of old reconditioned radios, the first thing guys do is they pull out all the old electrolytics and they replace them with shiny new ones. So it might be something with the electrolytics, difficult to say. They don't really document a lot of information of what the nature of safety circuits actually are. At least I haven't been able to gather any. You know, the companies, some of them are friendlier than others. I assume that that's a Chinese company. I don't think anyone outside of China makes lithium iron phosphate batteries. So you kind of stuck as far as the original manufacturer. You know, I mean, a lot of times they'll get the individual cells from China, they'll assemble them, sometimes in the United States, but they're always originating out of China. So, you know, the quality assurance sometimes is not quite what it might be.
I totally agree. Well, I didn't have too many hopes because I kind of tried everything except totally discharging. I'm going to try that with probably a 12-volt, one of those automotive bulbs. They're like 9 watts, 10 watts, and just, yeah, get it dead and try to recharge. Other than that, there's really nothing. And in the meantime, I found a sealed lead acid battery that was under the table for at least 5 years. This is the least. And it still has 12.3 volts. Almost didn't lose anything. I think fully charged was about 12.8. So go figure, what's better?
That's interesting to hear. I've never been that lucky. I use lead acid cells in my UPSs, and it seems like just about every 4 years, and it doesn't really, maybe it gets worked once or twice a year, probably a lot less than that. You know, if I'm shutting off a fuse or we had an electrical outage a year or so ago. But it usually doesn't get that much of work. But, you know, 4 years and the buzzer buzzes and incessantly, and I have to get a replacement part for it. So, that's pretty good for a lead acid cell. I don't know if it's innate to that particular manufacturer or that type. You know, there's all kinds of different lead acid variations. They used to be in the old days just an open water valve, and you would have to use a hygrometer and top it off with distilled water. Now they're sealed, and they have different types of technology that they have glass plating with layers of material sandwiched next to each other. So you know they're making them much more sophisticated than when they were originally invented. You know, 150, 160 years ago. But that's good for the for the lead acid cell. Four or five years, and it still has a decent voltage.
And it's funny, it's the same manufacturer. It's Expert Power, non-spillable, sealed lead-acid battery, 12 volts, 12 amp hours. Actually, they're identical in size, but, you know, obviously the lead-acid is about 2.5 to 3 times heavier. But, yeah, I just checked it with the meter, 12.32 volts. It's amazing, really, in like 5 years. I can't believe this thing didn't totally deplete. But, I'll try to discharge this one and, give it another shot. They have a little cheaper alternatives right now for the 12-amp, actually for a 16-amp hour, one of the Chinese batteries on Amazon. You can get them for about $75-$80. So it's not that big of a deal, but since, you know, I paid $100 and didn't really do anything, I decided maybe, there's a way to restore it. But, yeah, I'll try that, and if not, just get myself another one. Thank you so much for your help, Roy. KD2MDB.
You're welcome, Eugene, anytime. Whatever it turns out, come back and tell us. I'm always interested in how things turn out.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Roy.
You're welcome. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here to hopefully help with problems you're having, questions, discuss topics of interest, what have you. And if anyone out there would like to ask a question, make a comment, bring up a topic, please hit that push to talk. Okay, well, we'll give it one last chance. It's 9:42, and I'll just throw it out once again. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. to help with technical questions, topics for discussion, comments, what have you. So before we call it a night, let me throw it out again. If there's anyone out there with any questions or comments tonight for the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, please hit that push to talk. Okay, Bob. Well, it looks like you're going to get a good night's sleep tonight. If you have any closing comments to make, please feel free.
Not really, Roy. I guess we'll save the technic puzzle for the next time again. And, yeah. So, I guess better luck next time, I guess, in 2 weeks from now. I guess that's all I've got now. Back to you.
Okay. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York, and we meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting, club meeting, will be June 5th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin at 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues anywhere from 8:30, 9:30, 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month at 9 p.m. And we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 or near their upper sideband. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet, as well as our 10-meter net. You just type into your browser, stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services are generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. It's time to roll this all up and shut this down, but we'll be back to do it all over again May 22nd. You're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people who have participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'm going clear, and I'm getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, be well, and we'll talk again down the line. AC2GS clear.
73 Roy, 73 to everybody.